What populations are you focused on in Latin America? Who is marginalized, and what are some of the trends that you focus on?
I spend a lot of time in my work working with indigenous peoples and also with African descendants. Those groups tend to be of the most marginalized in the region. We know that African descendants make up about 150 million people, about 33% of the total population, but over 50% of the poor in Latin America. Indigenous peoples, the official statistics say that they represent about 10% of the total population. That's very low, and some of that is how people classify themselves and how others classify them. So sometimes when indigenous peoples are no longer living on their land, they may not self-identify as indigenous. They may consider themselves mestizo. Sometimes people asking the question may decide that someone is actually no longer indigenous if they're not wearing traditional clothing. We see in places like Chile, where the population is increasingly urban of indigenous peoples, there's a lot of discussion of what does it mean to be indigenous and how does one express their culture within an urban context. Not too long ago, I was in Guayaquil, and many of the young gang members in Guayaquil are actually young people who would probably most readily self-identify as indigenous, but because they're in an urban context, they kind of reach out for identity and they feel that they're not part of the mainstream, but they don't know exactly what they are, so they may be more likely to identify with a gang movement. Allowing people to express themselves and express their rich cultural traditions is very, very important. And I think probably one of the most important parts of development is to make sure that people can be inclusive of all parts of their identity.
Do you see a trend to struggle for identity more as populations mix and urbanize, as you say? That there's maybe a greater need or urgency to identify who we are as a culture because of the mixing of people?
I think so. I think one of the other aspects of this, and we can think of indigenous or traditional peoples as being stuck or static. And I think sometimes when we take a very anthropological approach and we look at the history and the language, we're ignoring the fact that indigenous peoples are vibrant. And part of being indigenous is being in the moment and living in the moment. And what's so exciting about these new movements is that we're seeing increasingly young people are using technology to reinforce their indigenous identity. And I remember not too long ago, I was with a group of young people, and they were talking about health projects and health programs. And at one point, someone said, well, isn't it difficult for you to relate to those of us who are not from your culture or your community? And he said, well, I have access to the internet. I know a lot about you. I still live in my traditional aldea or my tribal community, but I also use that technology to express my language and my culture, and I write in my language, or I do vlogs in my language. So he said, really, the people who are most ignorant in the room are those of you who don't understand our culture, because we understand you very well, and we use these tools to reinforce our cultures. I think when people are not able to do that, it's very difficult to move those kind of poorest of the poor, because if you feel like you're outsider or other, you end up being nothing. And I think that's the most challenging development situation that we have in the region.
Is lack of access to technology one of the factors that keep people isolated? Like, is there a big difference between indigenous folks that do use the internet and ones that don't?
Mm-hmm. I think technological access is important. That's where alternative technologies become so interesting. You can use solar-powered panels, or nowadays with cell phones, there are all sorts of ways that you can boost your signal and do so much from a cell phone that enables you to tell the story of your community. What we're also seeing is that tribal governments are taking governance very, very seriously, and they're beginning to use modern tools. I told a brief story about an indigenous group, and they're trying to understand what is buen vivir. The group is in Colombia, but this concept of buen vivir, which is now part of the national government policy discussion in Ecuador, and what these young people are doing in Colombia is they realized they needed to get better geo-referenced information about their territories. They do a household census where they ask their own questions, and some of the questions are standard census questions, and other ones probe into aspects of buen vivir. How is it that they feel about their indigenous traditions? Do they feel that the young people are holding on to the tradition? Do they feel that their language is being spoken? Things that are more intangible are some of the questions that they're asking. They wanted to get satellite maps, and they realized the cost was prohibitive. So they adapted a toy helicopter, put a camera on it, and they basically send up this toy helicopter several times a year to get up-to-date geo-referenced information and tools about their community. And then they overlay and do data visualization. So they take these images and then they know exactly where the concentrations of people are in the community, and they can see how the forest cover and the canopy looks. It's really fascinating. And I think with so much software available, you know, with the availability of open source and some of this technological sophistication that we're seeing, the possibilities are really limitless in terms of promoting development on your own terms and in your own way.
Are people in Ecuador using the same technology to monitor the forests? I mean, I know that in Costa Rica, it wasn't until there were many small planes going over forests that we could really see what was going on with illegal harvesting and so forth.
You'd be surprised that a lot of the environmental monitoring right now is actually taking place with drones. So drones, for this, I use the example of this particular community outside of Valle del Cauca in Colombia, because they used a toy helicopter, because even a drone wasn't accessible to them. But we're hearing more and more about environmental NGOs and community-based organizations that are purchasing their own drones.
I continued my discussion with Judith Morrison about large-scale development projects that work, such as conditional cash transfer programs. This is where people receive money for going to school on a regular basis or getting certain health exams, such as prenatal visits, for example. Now there are conditional transfers that go to whole communities rather than individuals. She said that both kinds of programs have been very successful.
IPEA, which is the Brazilian government research institution, it's very prestigious, has estimated that over the last 10 years, poverty decreased by about 23% as a result of the Bolsa Família program. There was also an attempt by the government to expand that program, and they created something called Brasil Sem Miséria, which targets even the poorer people than the Bolsa Família people, who weren't easy to identify or track, and made that really a priority. And we've seen that there's oportunidades in Mexico, there are programs in Panama, there are programs in almost, there are programs in Guatemala. This program has gotten a lot of attention throughout the region and has been replicated heavily. And even in the U.S. now, there a couple of years back, there were subsidies and transfers that were proposed for public education systems in Chicago and also in New York City. So it's an example of a mechanism that seems to be working well. In the Brazilian case, about 12% have graduated out of the program. I think the challenge is that it's hard to get out once you've started, but at least it's certainly helped with hunger, you know, decreasing significantly hunger levels and also increasing education levels.
Yeah, I would imagine it could be the beginning of turning around whole communities.
Exactly.
I understand your current research includes private sector partnerships and development. What sort of projects work well together, and what are the factors that help that be successful?
I think the most important way to engage the private sector is in areas where there are win-wins, where there's a mutual benefit. I think it's important to partner with the private sector in a very honest and transparent way. I think where you can find a business case, that's the most effective. And a business case that doesn't need to be heavily marketed, but a business case that stands on its own merits. I'll give you a very quick example. There's this hydroelectric dam that was having a lot of problems and had to stop. It was actually small-scale hydroelectric that was affiliated with a plant. And they had to stop running the plant several times per month because it would get absolutely cluttered with dirt and debris and trash and recyclables, actually, plastics and bottles and glass and cans. What they did is they created a partnership with a local recycling cooperative of very low-income people who would come in and clean the recyclables and clean the turbines and take out the recyclables. And as a result of that, their productivity went up extraordinarily high because they didn't have to stop the plant. So they basically, it was a solution that was a very clear win-win. Sometimes I find it very frustrating when I hear about solutions that may not be well executed, but that have some sort of private sector partnership, and you look at the budget and it's like the marketing budget's five times the actual amount of the project. So I think finding this space, and sometimes people will call it shared value, people may call it, you know, a win-win, but finding the space where it's really good business to do the right thing and to engage local communities. I think that's the sweet spot for public-private sector partnerships.
Yeah, and your example about the dam is just so sweet because it's so simple. It's easy, it's simple, it's small, it's, oh, who would have thunk it, you know, and then you just move on.
Well, and it sounds easy, but often what happens is that, you know, and sometimes these interventions are not very expensive either, but they sit in the marketing department or they sit in the community relations space. What I try to do when I'm thinking about private sector partnership is to really talk to the CEOs and the decision makers, because, and the people who actually have knowledge of how the business works, because that's the space where you can find those sweet spots. One of my frustrations over time is that, you know, we want to make sure that these are sustainable partnerships, not just one-offs. And the way you demonstrate that to a company is by showing them that it improves their bottom line, so that that way that CEO will continue to do it, and the next one as well, because it's good business.
Do you go about identifying or helping to identify some of these opportunities by simple negotiations? Like, okay, guys, what do you want? And you folks over on the other side of the table, what do you want? You know, and just trying to see if there's some common ground.
Definitely. And I think sometimes there's almost always a business challenge. I mean, all businesses have areas that they'd like to improve or things that they feel are not as efficient as they should be. And you can often find that local community-based solutions that can help move those areas forward. Whether you're a company that's in a remote location and you can't get good contractors to come in, well, that's a wonderful opportunity to create innovative partnerships with local communities. Or, you know, we see that over and over again, that a company, you know, works and builds up a local cooperative to provide any kinds of services, or even things like cleaning services or food services, or something like the dam where there was a problem and this kind of community-based solution served as the remedy. So I think there are enough areas that are challenging that I think some of it is the dialogue to figure out where are the challenges or where are the areas where you can really get more efficiency. And I hate to talk about just efficiency, that's such an economic term and sometimes leads to some really brutal outcomes, but it's about the efficiency and how to make the company as lean as possible. And I think we can even think about that from an environmental sense, you know, to make sure that all the resources are being used in a way that's responsible.
Is an unforeseen byproduct possibly also the mutual respect that the folks that are recycling the garbage may have more respect for the company and vice versa, the company knowing the local folks and caring about their well-being?
Without a doubt. And I think sometimes companies are beginning, and I think the companies that know how to do this best, and they don't often share their techniques, are oil companies. Because when oil companies have challenges with local communities, they know there's a cost, right? And if they're going to have a pipeline, they have a way of calculating that community unrest and what it means for their bottom line. And I think that is really interesting. And I think there's another way of looking at it, which is don't ever have that community unrest in the first place. And how do you build a partnership so that you don't have to stop production for extended periods of time, or you don't have to solve problems after they've started? How do you engage in a proactive way? And increasingly, we're finding that more and more companies are interested in doing that.
Finally, we turn to the subject of U.S. policy. Judith Morrison continued by outlining key factors to consider in evaluating what development projects we do and do not want to support. She encourages us to take a look at overhead costs and consider ways that our government assistance can be more efficient, more streamlined, that empowers more local communities. Let's make sure that U.S. assistance isn't so large that it doesn't replace foreign government efforts.
So again, this notion of identity, of giving people a voice, allowing people to express themselves and express their rich cultural traditions is very, very important. And I think probably one of the most important parts of development is to make sure that people can be inclusive, and inclusive of all parts of their identity.